You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
Welcome back to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities. We're now proudly part of the Crip and Co. podcast network, which is run by Andrew Gerza. And if you haven't already checked out their fantastic Disability After Dark podcast channel, I can highly recommend that you do so. But first, take a peek inside the Cabinet of Curiosities.
I think what mythical creature I would be and why has to be werewolf. I have always had an affinity for werewolves. I really relate to the idea of something inside you that is animalistic and angry and raw, and that once a month you're allowed to express all of that anger. And to turn into something bestial and something that wants to run and hunt and disappear into the forest and is part of fairy tale myth, the wolf as a part of fairy tale myth, is really interesting as a sort of predator, but also kind of a folkloric figure of mischief in that way. I would be a werewolf.
I am so excited to introduce my guest for this episode. They're hauntingly beautiful with an ability to pen venom so sweetly it looks like nectar. Kay Blair is a poet, workshop facilitator, and host of London Queer Writers Speak Equal Poetry Night. Kath, how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, I did a load of writing over the weekend that was sort of fun and experimental. So I'm really like, oh, I've written, I've done something, I've produced some art that is fun and interesting and a little bit weird. So I'm like, running off the high of that and then subjecting literary journals to it.
So is this the one that you posted about? Because you said that you'd written something so weird that you weren't sure if you could submit it.
But... yeah, it's got a lot of different fonts, let's put it that way.
Wow.
Yeah, I sort of played around with a lot of stuff looking at different ways of writing a piece of work. It's creative nonfiction, but also what does that actually mean and how does that look on a page? And what can you do when you want to tell a story, but you don't necessarily want to tell a story as an anecdote? You want it to be fun and interesting. So it kind of plays around with form in that respect, with kind of different ways of writing and different formats of writing as well. I took a couple, like there's a questionnaire in the middle of it as a bit of a fun thing.
Sounds amazing. Yeah. I'm in. I'm sold. Okay. I want to read it 100%.
Yeah, no, I'll just send it to you for free.
To everyone, yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So before we go any further, would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
For sure. So I am a poet for the most part, but I also write short stories and I've written at least one essay that's been published. I work with a group called London Queer Writers. We're a little sort of cohesive unit of poets and facilitators and academics working to present workshops. And we did used to do a LGBT poetry night called Speak Equal. We did it online for a little bit during the pandemic, but it's currently on hiatus as we search for a more accessible venue. And we're kind of in talks like, where are we going to be? Where's our new home going to be? And how do we hybrid that event as well? Because we had so many interesting people come because it was online and you don't want to lose those people because they contributed. Yeah, like you're a perfect example of somebody who came from that online space, which is great. We don't want to lose those people because they kind of kept us afloat during the pandemic. So
thinking about us, because I think a lot of people have just said, oh, okay, things are opening back up again. Let's scrap the online element. Let's not be hybrid anymore. So it's really good that you're considering your online community.
Yeah, we really want to hold on to those people because without them, we wouldn't have done like the few months that we did online. It's the problem with like trying to run two events a month is on a volunteer team is that you get very tired, and Speak Equal requires a lot more energy comparatively to the workshops. The workshops are a lot quieter and more relaxed. Yeah. And we also had less, you're paying one workshop host versus two features, and with like paying for Zoom is obviously its own price tag. And it's amazing that we could do pay what you can tickets, but obviously if you have costs associated with, you want to pay your artists appropriately. So we felt that workshops were kind of better in that way, because we can focus on one artist giving like help to other artists, but also make sure that they're paid appropriately for their time and for the work that they're doing.
Absolutely. Speak Equal seemed to create, more than any other poetry night I've been to, not that I'm throwing any shade on anyone else, but there was this real sense of community, and it was so clear that all of the volunteers that were running it and a part of it really cared. And during the pandemic, that was a wonderful little space to find. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you. No, we do love doing it. It was, so Speak Equal as and London Queer Writers was started in 2017 by Natasha Gilbert. She literally reached out to a bunch of us and were like, you're queer and you write, do you want to do a writing like collective together? And I said, yes, that sounds amazing. So in August of 2017, we met up in a pub in Shoreditch, and we just did writing together. And the team, like, it was a larger group of people, but we sort of developed Speak Equal. And then in February 2018, we had our first event at Farr School of Dance in Dalston. And from there, we kind of moved around a lot, because free venues in London are hard to find that are willing to take a chance on something like a poetry night. Yeah. There were a few months where we just were in different places. We were in the Water Poet in Shoreditch for a while before we had to move somewhere like north of the river for like 2 months, because somebody like corporate had booked that room and they were like, well, they're actually paying us money to use this room and you don't. So until we moved to the Jago in Dalston, and we were there for up until the pandemic, which is a really lovely space. And that was kind of our home for a really long time until the pandemic hit and we had to change how we did Speak Equal and how that looked. But now we're kind of interested in finding a new venue just in terms of accessibility, because as wonderful as the Jago is, we were on a top floor, so that's stairs, there's only two bathrooms. And we want to be slightly more accessible so that we're not isolating people out of that space. There's also sort of problems with having like a bar space, because the Jago, for example, had a downstairs area that they would sometimes rent out to musicians, and the musicians are told, hey, we have our poetry night upstairs, it finishes at this time, and if we're, say, not running to time, maybe we're 5 minutes over and the music starts downstairs and it's coming through, it kind of changes the vibe of your night. Yeah. Which is not to say that like they shouldn't have started on time and that we shouldn't have kept the time, but it does mean that you're kind of a, you know, quiet poetry night fighting against music, and that's not always the best atmosphere, but especially like you, when you've got somebody really quiet on the mic who's like maybe not too confident, or their poem is just quiet because that's the atmosphere they're trying to create, and you're like, we're very sorry, you have to fight with the music beneath us. Just looking at different venues, but also trying to find spaces that want to be collaborative and want to be a home for sort of an LGBT community, so that they feel like, oh, I'm going to go to this space and I know that it's going to be fine when we all like rush out of the doors at 10 o'clock at night and feel that that's safe as well, because that's important.
Like home is a really good way of describing it, because it is a very like supportive, welcoming environment. Is it, I mean, obviously I've got my personal thoughts about it, but how important do you think it is to have a writing or a poetry group that is specifically for the queer community?
I think it's really important to have that space, not as a like that it's the forefront of everything that we do and that it's like this is the only thing that defines us as writers, but I think a lot of spaces can kind of feel isolating for marginalized genders in particular. And as many like literary workshops as there probably exists in the world, having one where you know up front that you're not necessarily going to get into an argument with somebody about the intricacies of your gender identity or your sexuality
about existing.
It's important to have that space, and also to create community spaces for queer people that are not like club night focused or alcohol focused in particular. Which is not to say that those spaces aren't important or that those spaces don't serve a wonderful purpose in our history and as a way of like forming community. But I think for sort of, as Hannah Gadsby on her stand-up special once says, it's like, where did the quiet gays go? Like some people like the club scene is not necessarily for them. So you want to provide alternative spaces, because they should have a sense of community too that isn't necessarily tied to like, yeah, big club spaces or alcohol is like alcohol and things like that, especially for like, for me in particular, like I don't drink and that's just a personal choice, but it's sort of a different feeling if you're going to I went clubbing when I was at university, and it's a very different atmosphere as the person who's constantly drinking water comparatively to everybody else.
I know this well. I also don't drink now because I'm allergic to it, but before, I mean, yeah, I did drink, and going into those spaces now as someone who doesn't drink, it is quite different, and there is a different way of socializing with people. It's interesting. I think I've got used to it now, but yeah, I mean, some kind of big gay library that serves coffee would be amazing.
Book 28 actually is a new the new queer space where we both performed now exists, so that's reassuring to have have a little queer library space. But we, as many like queer spaces that are as possible, like queer gardening clubs and walking clubs and then obviously like sports clubs and all these different things, like
a variety.
You just need different spaces to express different things and to be able to enjoy those different things. And it's hard because you like physical spaces require money more often than not. Like, that's the kind of one of the problems of Soho, is that as much as it, you know, as much space as it has, it's like they have to be bars because bars make money. So you've we've had so many problems with queer venues being shut down because they don't have enough money to stay open.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's considered a risk for businesses to be a specific thing, especially for sort of queer spaces. You're kind of fighting against that, the ever hiking prices of rent in order to have a community space, which is why like, knowing that places like the LGBT community center that's just been set up and other places where it's like you can go and it's a specific space to be queer in are so important, because that feeling, like that physical sense of community, is as important as an online sense of community.
Absolutely. I mean, I loved discovering London queer writers during the pandemic, as I said, and like suddenly I felt connected to the community that I couldn't see, that I couldn't experience in a physical space. And I think creatively as well, finding people who aren't going to challenge your gender identity or your sexuality, because it isn't your total identity, as you were saying. It's not everything about who we are isn't wrapped up in our gender and our sexuality. But if you're creating it from a point of guarding, which sometimes you have to do if you're not in a queer space, I feel like automatically your creative flow is going to be stilted. So those queer spaces where you can be creative is really important.
Yeah, if you are going into a writing room and you're already restricting parts of your identity in order to not necessarily be outed, or you don't feel 100% like safe in that space, then whatever work you present is never going to be an authentic work, because you're having to censor yourself effectively, and that doesn't feel conducive to creative flow, and it doesn't feel conducive to your own personal creative journey, and means that the feedback that you get won't be authentic either, because you've had to restrict elements in order to make it palatable, which is the worst kind of creative sort of restriction.
Absolutely.
It's not fun to know that you're coming from a certain place on a work and not being able to actually talk about it, because you don't feel like the people in that space would be respectful of that idea or fully comprehend it.
And also having to censor yourself kind of line by line to make sure that nothing is accidentally slipped out. And you're creating from a place of fear then. But whereas at the open mic, I think we heard, there were so many non-binary poets. That's what I couldn't get my head around. I was like, this is fantastic. I've suddenly found this gorgeous space full of all these people who have varying like gender identities. It's great. And the one poet, and I can't remember their name, who described their gender as a dapper meadow, is just going to stay with me forever, because that is so perfect.
Yeah, just the ability to like, everyone's, the way they interact with their gender is very personable and very centered around just their own experiences and how they see the world. but to know that you can say something about your gender identity, and even though people don't feel the same, but they know what you mean instantly of like, oh, you've described it this way, that's amazing, like, I totally get what you mean, like, this is how it is for me in my own gender identity, like, this is how I identify in my non-binariness, how, like, and being able to kind of play off of that and feel seen, but also like enjoy the humor in like the unusual ways that you can express your gender identity.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so important to have these little these spaces where we can boost our power center, so that we when we do go out into kind of the wider world, we can maintain our sense of self and our authenticity. And then maybe someone out there who isn't able to access queer spaces then sees us present our weird little gender whatever, and they gain confidence, and that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, that's why I've been so enamored with the literary journal scene that's currently evolving, and all these different places that are independent literary journals publishing specifically queer work or work from writers of color, and being very upfront that they want specific work from people in the world, because it means that all those poets that I never knew existed are now accessible via like Twitter and the internet, and I can just look at their work and look to those web pages and be open to all these different sort of experiences and different ways of writing. But also because trying to break into mainstream publishing is incredibly difficult, so if your work is not sellable to a certain extent, then you might not get anything published, and it's really frustrating. Whereas these independent literary scenes are like, no, we want the weird and the hybrid and the experimental and the different. We want that because we want to champion that work, because that work doesn't get heard. And so you can submit to all these places and see all these different types of work and be like, oh, amazing, thank you that I get to read this and experience this and understand this, again, that there is a space for it in this world, and that we can all be inspired by each other.
Absolutely. I know when I was a reader for Prismatica magazine, the submissions we'd get in, and it's just this like real feast for the soul to get to read all these different queer stories and queer poems. It was really wonderful. But I think part of me is still quite cynical that mainstream publishing has maybe a few specific marginalized stories that it wants to publish, and then the rest, the stuff that is authentic, that is weird, that isn't, you know, exactly what they want to pitch or that they deem marketable, that kind of falls by the wayside. So
yeah, I think it's wonderful that we have all these sort of queer narratives coming out, and that I think young adult in particular has had a boom of like specifically queer stories, which is fantastic. But yeah, I think that there's a certain marketability that they're interested in, and it's diversity for like diversity bingo rather than is this actually like, do we want to publish this because this writer has got all these different things going for them, or are we trying to like look like we're diverse on the outside? And then publishing has its own, like mainstream publishing in particular, has its own internal problems wherein it's seen as a diverse industry because it has a lot of women working in it, but that's predominantly middle-class white women. Yeah. And even then they're sort of like men in high level positions. Yeah. And it has like a lack of editors of color in particular, which means that a lot slips through the wayside and can kind of mean that certain books get published even though they probably shouldn't have been. And that's not from a censorship point of view, that's literally from a like American Dirt, for example, by which is obviously like the scandal around that was that this white woman sort of presented a very particular view of Mexico that is not necessarily how Mexico should be viewed, and it was very sort of racist in its simplification of an entire country and an entire culture. And that happens because you have sort of high level people in sort of white people in high level positions deciding what is and isn't literary,
who somehow forget to get a sensitivity reader or actually look at things in a sensitive way themselves.
Yeah, and I think there's sort of this idea that what can and can't be told in a story, and whether it's like who gets to tell that story and why do we sort of put like other people's cultures in the hands of white people in order to get it to be literary and to be like book club worthy, when in reality it's like we should let people from these cultures tell the stories of those cultures, but also we should not limit them to those types of stories. Exactly. And they should be allowed to write whatever they want. And yeah, I mean, it becomes very exhausting to fight against that. It's very difficult to kind of get into mainstream publishing, and it's made harder by the sort of focus on what is and isn't literary and what isn't deserving of that space. And obviously, like, publishers have a certain quota and they can only publish so many things in a year because it does take a lot of time to put a book together, and there's a lot of work that goes into putting a book together. And that's not to say that publishers don't do an important job and that mainstream publishing doesn't like provide platforms for amazing writers and, you know, amazing books. But also, the sort of flip side of that is, in the UK, only 3 to 4 books are translated books from other cultures.
Interesting. So I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's we pump out so much stuff to the world, but we don't necessarily take in a lot.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and we haven't done that through history at all, like go and spread our message and our rules. Yeah.
No, and I think that's sort of slowly changing. There's definitely been a sort of a burst of like Japanese literature translated into English on the market that I've noticed. But yeah, if you're not getting books from other cultures that are very specific to those cultures in the sense that they're written by people from those places and then translated, then you're not getting that perspective either. So yeah, I think mainstream publishing has a lot to answer for in terms of why they have that specific model and what do they think about actually changing that. Because I imagine like that it's difficult in the sense that like editors do get thousands and thousands of submissions daily and have to deal with book agents and all of these different things. But yeah, I think publishing as an industry might have gone unexamined for a while just because with movies and TV you're physically seeing people on screen, so it's easier to see the lack of diversity there. Whereas publishing is, it's, you're not necessarily, you don't know the author or the people working in the industry behind it, so you can't necessarily pinpoint where you need to make the specific changes in order to actually have a proper change within that system.
And then ensuring that there's that people aren't just assumed to be perpetuating good authentic representation just because they're part of one marginalized community, like Rainbow Rowell for instance, who obviously, you know, has queer books out but has been held to account for some Asian stereotypes, I think.
Not for sure. Like, we as sort of white queer people definitely need to think about, just because we have a sense of marginalization through our queerness does not give us an excuse to not think about other forms of marginalization. I think like the gay community has a racism problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it definitely has a like dating apps and queer spaces definitely have had like big racism problems, which is unpleasant, but we have to deal with that. We have to be honest about that because it, you know, it pushes queer people of color out of those spaces and says that, oh, these aren't for you either, which doesn't help in terms of pushing for equality and really doesn't help in terms of feeling like a community.
Yeah, absolutely. And being defensive isn't going to help anyone. So it is up to us to hold each other and ourselves accountable and make sure that we do create welcoming spaces. We do tend to see people within marginalized communities punching down wherever they can, which is a very sad thing. So I know I was speaking to someone this week who said, just like you, you know, you said there's a problem with racism in the queer community. He was adamant that the worst level of prejudice in the queer community is ableism. And I think there's this tendency for some people to fixate on where they're not feeling included and actually forget that at the end of the day, if you've only got a couple of identities, which mean that you're subjected to someone else's prejudice, you tend to forget about the rest of what other people are going through. Whereas you could have somebody who is Black, disabled, and queer, who's definitely going to experience more toxic behavior towards them than, say, a white disabled person.
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, it can definitely be this sort of thing of, oh, I'm experiencing a very specific trauma in this space and that hurts me specifically, but forgetting that, like, race adds a very different layer to somebody's experience that means that they're sort of getting racism on top of, like, the ableism on top of the homophobia. And it, yeah, as white people, we can kind of forget that that happened because it's not how we interact with that space.
Thank you so much for putting that so much clearer than I did.
No worries. Yeah, it's difficult to reckon with. And I think that when you are responsible for creating a community space, you do have to sit back and sort of take in all the different ways in which, like, a space can be changed or a space can be unwelcoming, and you have to factor that in. And you can't account for everything because you have no way of knowing what that space is going to be on the actual night. A lot of, like, hosts talk about how do you get people off the open mic as an example of, like, being a good host, and how do you protect the audience while also protecting the person who's on the mic. And having to sort of reckon with people who come into spaces and perform racist or homophobic or transphobic or ableist poems, and having to be a confrontational person in that scenario. And how do you, like, not turn it into a confrontation in, like, a physical sense, while also, like, you have a duty as of care to your audience and making sure that, like, their needs are addressed. And
that must be a very fine balance to strike.
Yeah, it was. I will say it was slightly easier in a physical space because we used to turn up the music at the end of your 5 minutes if you were going over 5 minutes.
That's amazing. Perfect.
So there was a thing of, like, oh, you've gone over 5 minutes if there was somebody who was abusing the mic in that way. But it is very difficult, especially if they don't want to be held accountable. And so I think we had an incident where a white man used our stage as a way of talking about whiteness, and nobody asked for it and nobody wanted it. And Wonderful. Then he immediately, like, scarpered after he'd done his 5 minutes. So he didn't even stay for the night. So he'd clearly come just to perform and to just be a dickhead, essentially.
Wow. Transmit.
Yeah. And it being that thing of, like, cool, okay, so you've come to abuse our space and we can't even talk to you about it because you've left.
So you think it was intentional rather than maybe someone just being misguided?
I don't think it was intentional in the sense that I don't think he was malicious, but I do think that he read the room after he'd performed his poem about whiteness and didn't want to deal with the consequences of that.
Sorry, please tell me, what was his poem about white? Like, what was he saying? I mean, I can't imagine anything
other than the worst. I can't remember the specifics, but he definitely opened with, I feel like we don't talk about whiteness in the same way we talk about other races. And that was, like, and sometimes obviously, like, that can be just a sentence structure that he doesn't necessarily, you don't know what the poem's going to be. So you can't go off of that sentence. And he could have done a very, like, very sort of detailed and structured look at whiteness as an institution. He could have done that. He didn't, but he could have done. So you can't, as much as poets and writers are very eloquent when they write, sometimes you say something and you don't, it just doesn't come out right, but that doesn't mean that you have malicious intent about it. You've just not said it perfectly.
Sure. But then it's about developing an awareness.
Yeah. And for him, like, you're like, okay, what is this poem going to be? Let's kind of making eyes with other people in the room, like other members of LKW, like, okay, let's, maybe we're going to have to get him up early.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah. And as you say, protect your audience.
Yeah. Like, the audience came to have a good time.
Mm.
And, like, they don't necessarily want to come out and have to deal with sort of people who are using your stage as a platform for views that are not necessarily, like, about anything other than sort of their own self-importance sometimes. I think it can be really difficult in terms of, like, your duty of care to both parties, because sometimes it's not necessary that the poem is is dealing with, sorry to rephrase it, it's not necessarily that the poem is a poem about something that's bad, but you have to, but some person in the audience might not enjoy it or take offense to something in it, and it's not necessarily that it's an offensive thing, it's just that that's that person's personal experience is that they don't feel that the way that that poet phrased something was done with the best care. So you're kind of negotiating, like, well, we have to look after our audience, we also have to look after our performers, and you also have to give that sort of free space in order for people to express their views, but at the same time it's a real privilege to get up and be on an open mic and to have your work heard. So if you're gonna sort of throw it back in our face,
yeah, exactly,
by misusing that platform and by making like a sour note on a night that's supposed to be about community and supposed to be about sharing experiences and about, yeah, just having a good time.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I loved that you had in place was content warnings, and because as you say, you can't necessarily predict what's going to upset somebody in the audience, but at least if somebody is given a content warning, the audience members have got half a chance to then put their headphones in or step out of the room for 5 minutes, for instance.
Yeah, we were very clear about like giving people space to leave in order for them to protect themselves, but also so that you don't feel like you have to censor yourself if you're going to talk about things that are difficult.
Yeah,
because it transphobia is a perfect example in terms of some trans people want to talk about their experiences of transphobia, and they want to use like the language that was used in like the incident they're talking about, or they want to just talk about those experiences, and some trans people are going to be like, I didn't really want to talk about that tonight, like, or I didn't want to hear about that tonight because I have to deal with that all during my daily life, so I'm going to take the moment to step out of the room, go to the bathroom, like go to the bar and get a drink, and like, yeah, you have to provide like both spaces of like ability to leave in order to protect yourself, but also that space for people to complain about the stuff that affects them.
Yeah, and I think you all managed to strike a really good balance there, and it was just, it's just like a really lovely, welcoming communal space. So yeah, thank you. I hope Speak Equal comes back.
Yeah, we're definitely working to make that happen. We don't want it to go away forever. Like, we do want to have that, because I love hosting. Like, hosting is such a fun thing to do. Just from, it's performing, but you don't have to do any of your own work. Like, because as much as I love my work and as much as I enjoy sharing my work, I wouldn't necessarily call myself a performance poet or a spoken word artist, because I feel that my work is, not to say page poetry, and I think, you know, you kind of need the balance of both. Like, every page poet needs to be able to read their work aloud, and every spoken word poet needs things that work well on the page to have that balance and to have that sort of different ways of communicating. But with hosting, it's you know, it's high energy and it's fun, and you're looking after the audience and you're making people laugh and you're making people feel included, so there is a level of performance there, but I don't have to worry about like my own work, because what I'm performing is the character of the host, and I'm you know, making sure that the night goes smoothly and that everyone has a good time and that you're like, yeah, just enjoying the space of like being the person who's coordinating everything, but no one necessarily remembers you, because they remember the beautiful artists and they remember the beautiful work that they've heard, but they had a good time because you've helped facilitate that. There's a quote that I'd like to read from John Darnielle, who's the singer, the lead singer of the Mountain Goats. You know that your task is to show them a good time. It's actually a higher calling. To show somebody a good time is to give them respite from a world that can throw things like a pandemic at them. If you can take somebody out of that for 2 hours and then take them into a space where we all get to experience pleasure or sadness in a safe environment, that's awesome. And that particular quote really resonated with me, because that's the role of the host, but also the role of the artist, of like, I am here to provide you with catharsis or joy or sadness or pleasure for 2 hours, and that's the whole fun of it. That's how we get to be a community, is we get to do that in that space together.
Yeah, to hold others and to hold space for whatever they may bring in that particular moment. It's hilarious to me that as a host you are so supportive and so welcoming and so cheery, and then your work is dark as fuck. There's a content warning on one of your poems, Rural Patricide, which says religious horror, threats of violence, threat of human sacrifice. So I feel like this sums up your work pretty nicely. is that fair?
Yeah, I love horror writing. I love dark subjects. I love bones and blood and gore and violence within the genre of horror. And I think that there is a campiness to that genre that allows for such wonderful self-expression. And also just horror in general is such a fun space to play in, because it's such an interesting look at power structure.
Yeah.
Even in the goriest, bloodiest slasher horror, the threat is identifiable, and that can be incredibly cathartic for people whose threats to their existence are systemic. In the horror movie, the monster or the slasher killer or the psychological drama that we're undergoing is the threat, and it at the end either it consumes us or it gets killed, but it feels identifiable. And I think that's also why people love fantasy as well. The reason that Lord of the Rings is so wonderful is because we got to get this ring and we got to throw it into the volcano, and that is an objective and a task, and that's what we have to do to defeat the evil.
Oh my god, I wish life was that simple
as well. And it's wanting that escapism of an evil that is defeatable and is something that you can just deal with. There's a wonderful poet, Kim Den, who also writes horror and recently gave me a short story to read through that was about a haunted house. And the reason that the people chose to live in the haunted house was because it's much easier to live in a haunted house than to deal with the realities of renting.
I mean, yeah, true.
And
true.
Wonderful piece. I was so privileged to read it and give feedback on it. But it is that thing of actually, I would live in a house where the walls drip blood rather than have to deal with a landlord.
Yeah, I mean, what's the real horror here?
The ghost is something I can negotiate with or help move on or learn to live with. Landlords repeatedly come into your space and... and don't obey the laws that were put in place to stop them doing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And charge horrendous amounts of money for what is a box room, effectively.
Yeah, one is more of a threat to your life and has less of a soul.
Yeah, pretty much. And you're paying their mortgage. That's how landlording works, you are paying someone else's mortgage.
It's so depressing.
Then the reality of that is I paid rent on time every month, and the bank does not see that as a good enough behavior to grant me a mortgage to buy a house. So horror has that identifiable evil or that strangeness to it that is very enjoyable. I just love visceral words, and I love playing around with them, and I also just enjoy writing about sort of dark subjects in order to deal with my own thoughts about that and to kind of identify different ways of looking at the world. Rural Patricide is an interesting poem because it was written from, it's about a ritual sacrifice of a daughter, but the sort of conceited, the turn at the end is that she turns it around on the father.
It's so sweet.
And that's dealing with my own relationship with my father, which isn't to say that he tried to sacrifice me to a corn god, but is to say that I have a difficult relationship with this man, and I don't know how to necessarily deal with it in a way that is useful for either of us, but I can write this poem in order to explore it and to identify my own rage and to deal with my rage without it being toxic to my relationship to my father. Because it can be incredibly difficult when you're very, very angry to not turn it onto other people in such a way that is damaging and doesn't actually solve anything.
Yeah, so writing is a way of processing trauma and for healing and catharsis, absolutely.
Yeah, like I don't want to murder my father as much as I enjoy that in narratives, and as much as I value that in terms of that very cathartic thing of like, I don't want to do that and I would never do that, but in this poem I get to do that, and I get to explore that in a safe way, in a way that's about sort of dealing with that rage, but also being like, actually, you know, some things happened to me that made me angry enough that I've felt this feeling, and I don't know where it can go, so it can go into writing and we can play out that scenario. And also, if you are in a position where you are being oppressed, like for some people the power fantasy is to rise above it, but for some people the power fantasy is to be able to kill those who oppressed them.
Yeah.
And it's all about like how you sort of identify with that. And I definitely understand coming from a place of like, actually, I would just like to plunge a knife into somebody who has hurt me.
In a healthy and way, I would, on the page.
Yeah, and in a totally healthy way. But yeah, because for some people, like, they can forgive themselves, but they can never forgive that person for the trauma that was enacted upon them.
Mm.
And they shouldn't have to. But also, you can't, you know, you don't want to restrict somebody's creativity in that way, because they need to explore that and they need to come to an understanding of what that means for them. Writing about it is useful in that way.
Yeah, and writing to discover what the original trauma was, because sometimes we don't know, or sometimes we don't realize that we're still affected by it. So I think I got through the third edit of my fantasy novel before I realized that it was about being sexually assaulted, and I was like, oh wow, okay, this is still something that I clearly find deeply traumatic. And in the book,
no, for sure, like a similar, like I have a poem that really was not about anything other than playing around with language and playing around with the form of the prose poem, and it has a line in it, like, my father, who is not God, but who taught me to turn to a pillar of salt, would be a blessing. And I just liked the way that sounded.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. And it was just because, like, so I was raised Catholic, so prayers and forms of prayers, the way that they're put together can sound, like, Our Father who art in heaven is going to be in my head for the rest of my life, because I had to read that. Yeah, I got to say that so many times.
Catholic primary school, it's ingrained.
Yeah, and like Holy Mary, Mother of God as well. But also, like, because of the way that these roll off the tongue, you can kind of play around with them. So it's like, but returning to that line, like, my parents bought the book that that poem is in, the Valley Press Anthology of Prose Poetry, and he pointed out that line and was like, oh, is this about me? And I was like, yeah, it is about you, but also it's because it sounded good.
Yeah,
like, it's a really, like, good line. I really was proud of myself when I wrote it. So, like, so it's that double layering of, it's not about this, but it is also about this, but it's also not about that. Like, it might be, but it also is. Yeah, yeah. There's lots of, you can kind of get wrapped up in your own cleverness and not realize that you're dealing with, like, very sensitive subjects, because the way it sounds is, it came to you and it sounded amazing, and then you read back the whole thing and you're like, oh, maybe I'm going through it. maybe there's some things I should think about in more depth in terms of, like, for my own well-being. And then sometimes it is because the line sounds good and you want it to sound good. It's not anything deeper.
Those are always the lines that the editors pick up on, though, and they're like, it sounds really good, but what does it mean? And you're like, fuck off, like, maybe I just want it to sound really good.
The problem with Kill Your Darlings and having to remove stuff is that sometimes you would rather restructure an entire paragraph in order to use one line because it's so good, even though it's going to make you do more work in order to have it.
Exactly. I will take that hit.
Yeah, no, I've definitely done that where it's like, oh, this is really good. Where does this go? Oh, I'd have to restructure this to get it in. Is it worth it to get this one line in? And sometimes it is.
It's okay. I'll write a whole second novel about this. Yeah, exactly. Like based around this one line.
Yeah, always save the bits that don't make it in because you could reuse them.
Yeah.
Reduce, reuse, recycle.
I love it.
There's always work that can go somewhere else, even if it's not the perfect fit for that one piece. And I think that's the fun of it. It's like, oh, you didn't work for this, but I'll save you and maybe we'll find somewhere else for you to go.
That's a very healthy way of doing it, I think. So I've got a question. And it's kind of like feminism meets horror, because your poetry is beautiful and it's deadly at the same time. So you've got quite a few like housewives with a penchant for poison.
Yeah. I love the housewife figure.
Yeah, I've noticed.
Yeah, but it's fun to play.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you not in the know, I wear a lot of vintage fashion. At the moment I'm very into the 1960s, so it's a lot of mod dresses, but I do have a lot of 1940s and 1930s pieces. And I love like the traditional housewife dress and that traditional look, because it's such a, you know, it's very structured femininity.
Mm.
And it represents an era of structured femininity in such a way that feels sort of oppressive and cloying. And it definitely represents an era of advertising and the way that women were advertised and how they, you know, the housewife figure. This is what we're doing. You know, you can have a washing machine in your house, and you can have a fridge in your house. And then
women sold,
and it's
as a
very
product.
Much tied to, yeah, it's tied to the domestic, and it's tied to a lot of spaces. And it's also a very like interesting way of looking at that period in terms of feminism, because obviously in sort of the Western world, things like, oh, you couldn't have a credit card unless your husband allowed you to have one. It had to be your husband's name.
Couldn't open a bank account until 1970s without your husband.
Yeah. Yeah. And just this sort of generation of women all repeating femininity in a specific way and punishing other women with it. And obviously from a race point of view, punishing Black women and Asian women with very specific white femininity and the standards of beauty in that way. But also that figure is sort of it to be pitied, because she can't escape the boundaries that have been set up for her.
Yeah.
And that kind of, you know, the sort of stereotypes of the 1950s housewife and the husband who, you know, works all the time and cheats on her and doesn't treat her with any respect, but she's,
what a guy.
You know, she has to get a she has to get dinner on the table and a martini into his hand, and it's perfectly acceptable for him to hit her because that's just what happens in this time period, and you know, you need to keep your wife in line, and she can't be getting ideas. And then you have pioneers of feminism at the same time who are breaking those boundaries, who are choosing not to be restricted by it. So yeah, it's a fun character to play. And I think like the murderous housewife as a character on stage for me, and also in writing, is just fun to play, because you kind of see me on stage dressed in that outfit, dressed with the perfect makeup and the hair and everything. And then I'm making jokes about killing my husband, or I'm like playing around with it in sort of a drag way, and that kind of like going to an extreme of femininity in order to make the audience laugh, and in order to like just be funny, and but also kind of enjoy that sense of how I look in that outfit, because I look great and I enjoy I enjoy dressing for myself, but ultimately like I love compliments from other people. And
you look great tonight, by the way.
Thank you. But yeah, I love like fashion, and I love dressing well, and I love playing around with makeup. And so I also like I could perform this poem in my pajamas and it would sound just as good, but I could also perform this poem in this beautiful black velvet dress, and it, you know, you remember the poem, but you also remember how great I look. So
And I think
I'm sort of double imprinted in your mind.
It really sells it as well. And it does, you embody the characters that you're talking about, these women that you've pulled from decades past, and they're just this perfect depiction of what they were forced to be, but also of that rage that must have been bubbling underneath, even if it was just subconsciously, you know, that feeling of being oppressed and desperate and not being able to escape the situation that they found themselves in, until they do. And in your stories, they get to kill people, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
In a smash the patriarchy kind of way, not in a murder is good kind of way.
But I think also like you have this period of history, especially like the 60s and 70s, where like food suddenly becomes convenient food. So the act of cooking, they're like, look, all these things we've done for your convenience. And then it's like, well, you've taken cooking away from these women, so how are they going to fill the day? Like, and that, you know, things like that. So yeah, I have a whole poem about aspic.
You do,
Boomers Killed the Aspic is what it's called. Talking about how it takes a long time to make aspic. It takes up to 4 hours refrigeration and you've got to boil everything down. But it's an interesting dish because it's such a symbol of affluence, because it shows that you have a fridge and it shows that you can do refrigeration, which for that time period is a symbol of wealth. So to make it even, and obviously like lots of cultures have aspic in forms, like there's Vietnamese have like pork jelly, and then Russia I think has aspic as well as like a thing that is a part of their culture, but the American version of it in particular is incredibly unappetizing to look at, but requires so much. Because it's like, it's a full can of spaghetti O's in it, and it's like meat and vegetables, but like not with the care and consideration that other cultures maybe have brought to it. It's like, no, we've just put something in jello. We've Americanized it to the point that it's unrecognizable, but it's such an interesting, it is this interesting dish of like, it takes so long to make, it's a symbol, it's a weird symbol of wealth, and then it's served cold. So you serve it cold in order to, and yeah, which is a very strange, like for a dish that has a lot of like meat and fish, and like you could put a whole fish in, like some people put whole fishes in. So it's, it's an interesting like look at food in terms of what food symbolizes outside of nourishment and what food symbolizes to the world. But also, yeah, it is a poem that is about that housewife, like counting out poison, putting it back, looking at the knives in the drawer, serving, you know, you could kill your husband, but the aspic took so long to make, so you should serve it because you put all this effort into it. The last line sort of about her holding up this sort of this teaspoon of jello and seeing like a lipstick stain on her husband's collar that's like a shade that he said was unflattering on her.
Yeah.
And just that thing of having to like swallow your rage under that. And
the tension contained within those lines is amazing.
Thank you. It's a tense atmosphere. And then also, there's sort of, you want to see that dress bloodstained because it's ruining the staining of something that's meant to be pristine. And why should Patrick Bateman be the only one who gets to stain his pristine suits from the 80s? But like, I think it's the marring of something that's supposed to be beautiful and feminine and delicate, and being like, no, I want to ruin this specifically. There's a horror film called Ready or Not where the main character, it takes place all in one night, and the main character's in a wedding dress, and progressively her wedding dress gets worse as the night goes on. So it's this beautiful gown that then she has to rip so that she can run better. It gets covered in mud, it gets covered in blood. Brilliant. And it's such a beautiful piece because it's like watching this, as she suffers, the wedding dress suffers, and the sacrifices of all of these beautiful things in order to survive. This beautiful symbol of union and matrimony, and how it gets ruined by the end because the family chose to ruin it.
Excellent. I'm gonna have to look it up. So I love horror. And as I discussed with Rick in the first episode of this podcast, horror is a playground where we can learn how to defeat the monsters in real life. But as a genre that has a tendency towards toxic tropes, such as disabled people as monsters or women as white silk clad victims, I've got to be quite careful about the sort of horror that I indulge in. But your work seems to take these tropes and flip them on their head, the representation of women, at least. And you seem to be a staunch supporter of the final girl. So are you are you intentionally tackling feminism?
I don't think... I am somebody who, like, very much believes in feminism as political praxis rather than a genre of work. Mm-hmm. Because I think the problem with categorising anything as feminist when it comes to an art piece is that it gets watered down and it doesn't... Like, so many books at the moment get touted as feminist when in reality they're just books with women in them. And it's, and that I think is a is an issue where it's like, this like, the sort of strong independent woman trope, and it's like, is that actually feminist? Because women should be strong and independent and should be able to like support themselves, but do they have layers beyond that? Are they complex individuals? Are they able to be like a 3D person, or are they so girl bossed as to become completely like unreachable? Because then you have the other side of it, which is the girl boss culture, which is like, I'm a strong independent woman, but at the same time I'm being exploitative of people, and I am using my girl boss status as a way of exploiting others' work, or as a way of making it about hustle culture. And I don't think that's not necessarily feminist either. So I definitely view my work through the slant of like, I want to do right by women, but at the same time it's about equality of all genders, so I want to do right by everybody within that work. Because you want to, with horror in particular, you want to flip the script. You don't want to be voyeuristic in the way that you approach women, because that genre does have a problem with like having loads of women on screen but a lack of agency and a lack of sort of depth,
almost no positive representation. There's no
and I think women in particular are punished for sex on screen with horror in a way that men necessarily aren't. There's the sort of trope of the final girl's usually a virgin, whatever that even means. The girl who gets killed off first is usually promiscuous. There's a lot of scenes where it's about punishment of sex, and it's kind of a look at purity culture in that way, and the fact that like people are punishing sex in general. And then there's so horror, and as you said, with especially with like disability as a horror like trope is horrible, because the reality of that is not just like from a sort of mental psychosis point of view, where you make asylums a horror setting, not done in a way of like, I am a person who has suffered under that institution, but as a, this is a place where loads of people died, so we thought it would be fun for a horror game. And it's like, no, that's not great either.
What's the killer's motivation? Are they're deformed, or they were, you know, outcast because they were disabled?
Illness. I enjoy like body horror as a concept, but I also, you have to be careful when tackling body horror, because it's like, is the horrific like, oh, they have too many eyes, or like limbs where there shouldn't be limbs, or they're like, they have a mouth in their stomach, rather than, oh, you've taken somebody's like disabled form and made that into a horror trope, because like that's someone's life that you are describing as horrific and choosing to make into the monster, and that only serves to make disabled people alienated, but also puts the idea in people's heads that that's something to be feared, which doesn't help the disabled community. That only makes the disabled community feel more isolated.
There's consequences in the real world.
And I definitely think that like horror has, you know, horror has also used black bodies as a way of indicating fear and capitalized off of that, and definitely needs to change in terms of like how it looks at loads of different marginalized communities.
It's definitely, but it's also
the balance of like, also like you need to get more creators behind the screen and behind the pen who come from this marginalized community, who want to write horror and who get to talk about their experiences, so that you have films like Get Out, where you're talking about like whiteness as a power structure and what that means. The fact that like the new Candyman looks at the white supremacy issues in terms of the original, in which a white woman goes to a black community and decides to write about them as if they're academic subjects rather than real human beings.
Yeah.
And the new Candyman being like, okay, so we're going to not say that that story didn't exist, but we're also going to like look at it in a different way and try to, as black creators, like reclaim that story away from like a white lens.
And moving away from having a diverse cast, which the same violences are then enacted upon.
Diversity on the screen only goes so far if you don't have anybody behind the screen who is writing, producing, directing. Because you can have as many people of colour and queer people and trans people on screen, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good story or that
you'll still have a white male hero. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll still have like racist tropes.
Terrible
being reenacted rather than like actually looking at something because you have a white director. So it's a white director's gaze continually, and how the film is edited as well. So yeah, it's an interesting genre because I think a lot of people see themselves in the other, but they're also a genre that you kind of get burned by because there's a sort of sense of your otherness as a something fearful.
Yeah. But I mean,
it's negotiating an interesting line.
I do love it. And if I find a good horror that isn't, you know, completely abysmal in terms of representation, then happy days, it's great. I find if I'm stressed as well, I'll lean more to watching a horror than I will a comedy. Because as you were saying before, with a horror, fantastic. I can see my problem represented by the big bad, and then I can go and kill it voyeuristically through the character.
Yeah, and there's lots of like queer people working in horror, like off the top of my head, like Brian Fuller, who directed the TV series Hannibal, is a gay man. The director of Chucky is a gay man. The original movies, and then the new TV series has like a gay kid as the main character. So Joel Schumacher, who directed Lost Boys, is also queer. So like you've got loads of like, there is quite queer people working in horror who work within the bounds of censorship, as it were, but also of making things that are interesting. I think we also just like Halloween is gay, is like the gay holiday. It's become that. But I think also the campiness and the pageantry to horror that allows you to sort of play around with. I love other, like, you know, I love other genres. I'm a big fan of science fiction and I'm a big fan of fantasy, but those, you know, and those genres run into the same problems in terms of representation, but also in terms of what what is fearful within that. It's hard to write villains because on the one hand, you don't want to demonize any particular traits about a person. But on the other hand, you don't want to make them sexy either, because that's its own like problem and kettle of fish.
Yeah, absolutely. Sexy,
like, if our villains are hot, then everyone's going to fall in love with the villain, which is not, you know, there are villains that I enjoy and who I'm like, yes, you didn't do anything wrong. You should have been allowed to do this. Are problematic faves. But yeah, it's kind of trying to write sort of a diversity in terms of villains as well as a diversity in terms of heroes, because people can come from the same place and have very different interactions with the world. And then one, you know, you can give everybody the sort of same treatment in terms of you can treat them with kindness and with love and with understanding. But for some people, they can either get the right messages from that in terms of like self-improvement and moving up in the world and learning to love the things about themselves. But at the same time, that's for somebody else, they can internalize the wrong lessons from that, and it actually sends them on a different path, on a worse path, because whilst they have not necessarily, you're giving them the same attention and the same sort of things of kindness, but they're taking sort of different things from it because they're a different person with different experiences in terms of how they've grown up. So that's interesting to see. Yeah, it's interesting to see narrative foils in that way and why people go down the paths that they do and what choices they make in order to be the people that they are. I think the sort of thing about heroes and villains in particular, or one side of the argument to the other, is it's kind of, you can be presented with the same choices, and who you are as a person determines what you do with those choices.
Yeah.
And for some people, it's a redemption arc, and for some people it's a corruption arc. and those are both really interesting to explore. Yeah. Like, I think that's why people love tragedy fundamentally, is that it's like people will go and see Hamlet and the Oresteia and all of these different things because the tragedy of knowing that it's going to end badly, and that they're going, that the choices, you know, at any point these characters could have made a different choice. But yeah, because of the narrative and because of who they are as people, they will always make the same choice. So, and the outside of the audience being like, if you could have made a different choice at any point, but you didn't, because that's who you are as a character. And that's why this ends the way that it does. And the catharsis of that and the enjoyment of like, oh, you know, you can't escape this narrative, but in that there's so much can be found and discovered and understood.
Fascinating. So have you got a poem for us?
I do have a poem for us.
So excited.
Yeah, I was sort of flicking through when looking at what work I wanted to perform, and this poem that I wrote last year stood out to me because in November of 2020, I changed my pronouns and I changed my gender identity to non-binary because I had discovered that about myself. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this poem kind of in response to that, because I wanted to explore that. And it's called My Response for When Someone Asks Me What My Gender Is After Changing My Pronouns to She, They. So, after Gender Envy by Auden Patrick, a duplex after Jericho Brown. I am the pretty thing that lives in the house, meaning I want to look like a slow burn horror movie, meaning I want to look like the behind the scenes photograph of the creature from the Black Lagoon holding Julia Adams, bridal style. I want to be both the creature and Julia Adams, wanting to hold and be held, feminine and monstrous. Hold the feminine like a J.C. Leyendecker illustration, the advertisement for the Arrow Collar Man, where the Arrow Collar Man and a fur-draped lady stand on a golden staircase looking down on what one assumes is a swinging party. I could do with attending a swinging party, where I am both Jeanne d'Arc and the burning pyre and the witnesses, witness the building burning down around me as I am the pretty thing that lives in the house.
I fucking love that poem so much. You sent it to me before tonight, and I just read it and I was like, yes, this is very close to how I feel about my own gender. Thank you very much.
Well, that's amazing. That's great. But yeah, the sort of non-binary is such an interesting thing to come to learn about yourself, because for so long I was like, well, I'm really I'm feminine, so I'm a woman. Like, that is what it is. It's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, I have no. It's interesting because I distinctly remember. When I was at university, I shared a house with some people, and one of the people, Dana, talked to me about their gender, and because I was like a queer person who'd been in the community for a while, and they wanted to kind of talk it out with me, and this was part of our friendship, and also we talked about lots of things. We talked about philosophy and politics and narrative, and because I was an English literature student and they were a politics, philosophy and economics students, so we talked about so many different things, and we talked about gender, and I distinctly remember telling Dana, well, I'm a cis woman and I feel comfortable in that, and I feel like that's who I am. And then with the pandemic and having to deal with looking at my own face on a Zoom screen a lot more, and also like becoming closer friends to sort of some non-binary people, and realizing that like, oh, I don't have to give up femininity completely. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do. I can just be this person in my body and say that this is how I feel, and that is what it is. So
yeah,
I am who I am regardless of what I'm wearing or how I'm choosing to present in terms of makeup, and that's fine. Like, it doesn't have to be anything more than it is.
You don't have to perform it in a certain way.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of strange obsession with androgyny when it comes to non-binary people, because it's a way of...
I was going to bring that up
next. Yeah, I think it's a way of brains being able to categorize. I think we as human beings gender people because that's how society has taught our brains to work. So we gender masculine or feminine just automatically, and then through learning and unlearning, we get rid of those biases and don't assume. But when you're coming to it and sort of unlearning some of that behavior or learning how to negotiate that space, and you only see like very thin white androgynous people being touted as the pinnacle of non-binariness, and you don't fit that particular like aesthetic but also look, you're kind of like, okay, well, that's not me, so how do I factor into this? And so, I think also, yeah, just like feeling that you can't identify as trans if you're not going to transition, and that problem of that, of like, not every trans person wants to transition, even if they are considering hormones or whatever. Like, transition is something that can is very personal, and different trans people choose different points during that journey to stop and don't, you know, and it's not necessarily about like that full exploration of that, and you don't have to explore it at all. You can just say that this is what you are, because that is what you are.
Yeah, there's no rules. I mean, this is your gender. You get to be exactly who you want to be. And I think as soon as people figure that out, it's a wonderful thing. But as you say, the issue is that what's getting fed back to us is, you know, skinny white androgyny. And then we kind of lose our place in society, because you've got the non-queer community not really understanding you and not being able to fit you into a neat little box. But you've also got the queer community possibly not always treating you in a very empathetic way. What have you found? Yeah, what's your experience of being non-binary?
I think because it's been a pandemic, it's been significantly like reduced in terms of public interaction.
Yeah.
But I'm well aware that like I am always going to be read as a woman because of the way that I look. Like I am sort of slight and quite sort of, I usually wear makeup. I have hair that is sort of, at the moment, is like past my collarbones. And more often, like, you know, especially if I'm doing that housewife character, like I'm in a dress. So like people will clock me as a woman, and I don't necessarily care about the person on the street and how they read me, because their opinion doesn't matter, because they've seen me for 2 minutes. Like, it doesn't.
Yeah,
like they have their own things that they have to unpack about how they read me, and if they're not making it my problem, then it doesn't necessarily bother me. I think that if I'm going into a space and I've expressed a queer space, and I've expressed a desire to be referred to predominantly as they, them, or like said that I'm non-binary, and then it's being reflected back at me and they're not respecting that, but that hurts more rather than the random stranger who's always going to clock me in a certain way because I've presented in a feminine way, so they're going to read me as feminine, and that makes sense for how society is structured. It's also, yeah, the dual pronoun of still holding on to she, her, and also using they, them. Of like my preference is sort of changing it per sentence.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's how I, a lot of my writers' bios, like when I'm handing them off for publication, it's usually I change the pronoun per sentence to kind of, or as an example as well, of being like, this is how you can change it. But when I was employed, I just changed my pronouns in my work email signature, and I didn't tell anybody because I did not want to have to explain it. I didn't really present it when I was employed, like at work, in a particular way, because I just did not want to deal with it. And it's not that I thought that anybody would be judgmental or that anybody would say anything. It was more the fact that like I'm still figuring this out, and I want you to see that it's happening, but I don't want to have to field any like in-depth analysis about it, because at the end of the day, like, I don't know who I am right now. This is something I'm trying out. And I think trying out pronouns just to see how they fit is a healthy thing to do.
Definitely. Yeah. Everyone should just have a go. If you're considering whether you should be, you know, referred to using different pronouns, try it out for a week or a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think we want to be settled in ourselves. So we don't necessarily want to be experiencing great things of change, because I knew I was bisexual from quite a young age. And then it's this thing of like sort of knowing I was bisexual and then getting to university and then realizing I was asexual as well. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. I didn't expect a change here. I didn't expect to discover like asexuality in the middle of university. This is interesting. And then coming out of that and working and being an adult and being like, oh, you're non-binary as well. Oh, change, another change. But we're not quite static. Like we're the community obviously hates the phrase that it's just a phase, and because it does imply that it's not real. But I do think that you can change as a human being, and something that you wanted or something that you thought about yourself a couple of years ago is not necessarily applicable to the person that you are now.
We adapt.
And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, we adapt. Yeah, as much as we adapt because of situations that we have to tolerate, we also change in wonderful ways when we find new openings within ourselves. I think it's healthy to be fluid, to kind of go with the flow of what our hearts want. And that sounded so airy-fairy, but...
Yeah. It's true, as sort of cliche as it sounds, the heart wants what the heart wants. But sometimes, yeah, you'll want to be different, or something that initially felt correct and comfortable no longer serves you.
Yeah.
And that's okay to throw it out and to try something different. And I think as long as you've got people around you who are gonna support you, then that's totally fine. Like, it's been interesting. I publish under the name Kay Blair because my full name, Catherine, is spelt the same way as Tony Blair's daughter, which is unfortunate, because she's obviously considerably more famous than I am. So if I want to be findable on the internet, it's impossible because you'll get pages and pages of her. So I changed my publishing name to Kay Blair and then committed to it. But it was, yeah, I got a message from a friend recently being like, oh, I didn't realize you changed your name. Is it totally okay to still call you Kath? And I was like, yeah, no, 100%. No, it's it's the name I published under. It's totally fine. But yeah, it's like...
The issue's been a writer.
In a lot of spaces, I want somebody to use that specific name in that specific space because it's about being an artist, but it's also if people want to find me after the show, after they've read something, then they need something that they can actually find and is Googleable. And then when we get to know each other, you can call me Kath and it's totally fine. And you know, maybe in a few years, I'll be like, actually, I want to change my name completely and we'll have to, you know, because Kay Tempest, for example, changed their name recently.
Yes.
And it's the thing of a lot of Kay Tempest's work is obviously published under the name they used previously.
Yeah.
That's what they had to do in order to feel to be an authentic version of themselves. And going forward, that's who they are. So.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah. Change your name, change your pronouns, change your hair.
Exactly. Dress like a Victorian gentleman.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just me. Yeah.
100%. Like, wear whatever you want, or whatever you feel comfortable in.
Evolution. Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. We evolve.
Evolution.
Yeah, definitely. We're not meant to remain stagnant. And this one fixed kind of iteration of a being, we need to evolve.
Yeah. We're not going to be the same person we were last year. Or even 5 minutes ago.
I think though, these are really good opportunities to sit down and to write, and not just to explore your gender or your sexuality, but also who you want to be, who you want your future self to be. And I think writing gives us that opportunity in a very low risk way.
Yeah. And I think also you should just write whatever you find interesting.
For
me, as much as I write things that are personal to me in terms of they're about my relationship with my father, or they're about my gender, or they're about Catholicism and my relationship to growing up in Catholic school, at the same time I also write things that are just jokes or are intended to be a piece of artwork. There's nothing personal in it. There's nothing in it beyond my desire to create art. And I think that poetry has this real problem where because it is so personal in terms of the way people talk about their experiences, there's an assumption that all of it is personal, or that the I in the poem is the I who wrote it.
Yeah.
When that's not always true, or it's deeper than that. And yeah, sometimes I write things that are just nonsense because it's the joy of writing nonsense.
It's healthy to enjoy some nonsense. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I don't think you have to be writing anything that's especially deep and meaningful and poet laureate and all, because at the end of the day, thinking about the longevity of your work stifles it, because you're preoccupied with how it will be received rather than what it is at all. And you know, we all write for different reasons. And one of those reasons at the end of the day is attention in some capacity, because if we didn't want attention for it, we'd, you know, put it in a drawer and never look at it and it would just be personal. Like, I don't publish because, you know, I publish because, like, I wrote this piece, I made art and I want to share this art. And yes, I do want attention for that art and I do want praise for that art if you like it.
It's good to be honest.
But thinking about its longevity beyond its place in the world when it's published is a fool's errand, because ultimately you're preoccupied with, like, legacy and continuation, when really you should just be preoccupied with the work and what you're doing with the work and how you can get better at writing and the different things you'll do next time when you write the next poem.
Yeah, and the way you get better is always going to be to not stifle that flow. You know, actively encourage nonsense, have little nonsense breaks, have little times when you say that you're just going to write shit for 5 minutes or...
Yeah, like I ran a workshop for London Queer Writers recently, which is about creative limitations. And one of the exercises I had people do was to go to Wikipedia and click on random article. And the joy of that is it takes you to just a totally random Wikipedia article. And I was like, cool, that's the subject of your poem. You can read that article. You can read, like, the whole thing. You can, I want at least one fact from this Wikipedia page in your poem, but that's the subject. Go. And it can be as loose or as, like, tight as you want in terms of, like, how close you are to the subject matter. But, like, and you can put the personal in it, or you can take the, but more likely you're going to get, like, you're going to get an actor who you don't know, or a time, an event that you don't know, or a piece of science that you don't know. So you can't put anything personal in it because you don't know anything about it. And that's the joy of that exercise, is to
that's
be like...
That's a brilliant exercise. I'm going to start doing that in my own practice. Thank you.
That is for you, for everyone. Do it. It's so fun, because Wikipedia is a excellent fount of knowledge and has that feature of just, like, clicking random article.
Yeah.
So, like, my caveat was, like, if it's something, like, triggering or particularly unpleasant, then you can click again and choose a different subject. Like, I didn't want anybody to have to write about something that was, you know, I didn't want anybody to, like, if they got the Manson murders, for example, I didn't expect them to write about that, because that's a horrific thing and you don't, like, the that was the kind of, like, asterisk to be like, if it's something that it really unsettles you, then you don't have to write about it. But then we got some interesting poems about artwork and about an actress that the writer had never known, didn't know her body of work, and about space. So
fantastic.
Yeah, it kind of gives you the opportunity to kind of learn something, but also,
and there's a lot more depth in that as well, because I mean, I used to flick through a book and then pick a random word and then do, you know, a poem or a short story based off that is very limited in terms of, you know, what your imagination is going to conjure from that. But having a whole article, I think that's a really good idea. I'm gonna as I said, gonna use that
please listeners, please do. You can DM me on Twitter to be like, this is the article and this is what I wrote, because I would love to read them.
You're gonna be inundated.
I always am appreciative of people who have taken, like, my workshops or my exercises, and they share the work with me afterwards, because it's really fun to see what you came up with. The other two exercises that were in that was one was, like, to write a duplex, which is Jerrica Brown's amazing poetic form, because I think modern poets, I think we shy away from form because it feels daunting, because there's so many different pieces.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Two forms. But Jacob Sam LaRosa, the amazing poet and workshop facilitator in himself, did a sort of Apples and Snakes ran a series of workshops, and he was one of the workshop leaders for that. And he said, talking about form, was like, break it down so that it's not daunting. And also, if you've written a 14 line poem, you've written a sonnet. Like, that's how many lines a sonnet is. So you've written a sonnet. The rest is just sort of flavor and adding and learning how to do it in terms of, like, the specifics of that form.
It doesn't need to be as daunting or as scary as I think most of us assume it's going to be.
Yeah, and also, if you write it and you hate it, that's okay. You've exercised your brain at the very least.
Yeah, I wrote Sestina and I absolutely hate it. But, I mean, it occupied me for a few hours.
Exercising your brain is as important as sort of the creation of a perfect art piece. But also, yeah, I said in the workshop, I was like, we don't see the like 40 versions of that form that came before the actual final printed published poem. Like,
yeah,
we as the sort of reader come to that poem as like the fully like it's done and it's finished and it's perfect.
Yeah.
And we come to it looking at it and being like, and that is daunting because you've seen the final version, but you haven't seen the like 40 drafts.
Yeah, and the poet
that it took to get there,
banging their head against the table. Yeah.
And throwing their notebook across the room and being like, it's never going to be done. Like, like
exactly.
Like I hate it. Why did I write it? Like, yeah, I think when we see the final product, we forget about the process it took to get there.
Mm.
So that when we go, and then when we come to our own process, we're like, well, it doesn't, you know, Marilyn Hacker and Shakespeare and Gwendolyn Brooks just wrote it and it was beautiful. It's like, no, they didn't. They had to slog it out sometimes too.
Exactly.
Like sometimes they woke up and they wrote an amazing line, and sometimes they woke up and they wrote absolute garbage that they threw out and we'll never see because it's lost to time.
Well, I think your students are very lucky to have somebody with such words of wisdom. When are you, have you got any more workshops lined up?
LQW definitely does. Okay. We are planning to do a workshop at least once a month in order to like facilitate work, because our workshops, when we did them in real life, they were poorly attended, which I think is just a problem of London and time and getting to a physical space. And the beauty of the online workshop is that people can tune in from their homes. They write it at their own desk.
Mm.
You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to be on time for anything. I think series of workshops in terms of like it's every single week benefit from the physical space, but one-off once a month workshops really benefit from the online space.
Okay.
Because you tune in from your own home and you just do it and then you log off and it's sort of, you don't have to get home and you don't have to do anything. And it also has facilitated like people coming in from outside of London because it's online, and also being able to have workshop or featured artists who aren't from London and who we couldn't afford basically the first time around, because as much as you want to pay your artists what they're worth, if you have to factor in a travel cost and you're not necessarily making a ton of money from your event, it means that some artists, unless they're going to be in London and the dates all cross over, you can't necessarily get certain artists, which is a real shame because their work is amazing and you want to experience it. So having that online space of like, cool, we don't have to pay for your travel, but we will pay you for your time, means that, you know, it means that we've been able to get some really cool people from sort of all over the country to lead workshops rather than just the London, greater London area.
It makes it possible, yeah, for you as a group and also for the artists and for people attending. So that's brilliant. That's fantastic. Well, I will put the link to LQW's Facebook page.
Yeah, the Facebook page, because that's where all our events are. And then me personally, I'm just writing. I currently have a fiction podcast that's in development, which means that it's written, but it needs to be edited and then recorded. I finished all the first draft before the end of last year, so the end of 2021. So they're handed off to my producer, like, here, I've done it. I've fulfilled one part of this bargain.
Oh my God, you're so fancy. Then, you have a producer. So this is like a lot more organized than my little setup here.
Yeah. My beloved producer, Nemo Martin, who's my dear friend and co-conspirator, collaborator, the person who puts up with my insane nonsense, but also I put up with theirs because we all have a hive mind and the pandemic has meant that we've like gotten incredibly close because we have a group chat, but also, yeah, just like learning things about each other to the point where we're like, oh God, we are all the same person. We've blended. We're just one being now. But yeah, Nemo and I are working on this podcast together. They is the producer and me is the writer. And then I'm also in it because I'm playing one of the roles. And then we're going to have, it's called The Last Lighthouse. And it is a science fiction kind of podcast in which five scientists go to an island in order to investigate the strange flora and fauna and just the island's general weirdness, and then it kind of carries on from there and things happen to them and it's going to be a bit horror and a bit fantasy and all these different things.
And when is this out?
Hopefully we're gonna for the end of this coming year. We'll see how it Nemo has a lot of their own projects, so it's kind of like we need to coordinate and make sure that like we actually get together and work on it, but it's definitely written, which is half of the battle.
That's a huge part of the battle. Well done. I'm so excited to listen to that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's gonna be fantastic. Yeah, I'm really excited to make it because I love fiction podcasts. And like it's inspired by a lot of like my favorite podcasts, but also my favorite writers. And it's kind of draws from a lot of elements in terms of like what I've been reading, what I've been like listening to. I think audio drama is fantastic. And in all honesty, when my very first podcast was Welcome to Night Vale, and I just assumed that all podcasts were fictional until I was maybe 17.
That's fantastic.
Until I just assumed they were, because that's the only ones I listened to were fiction. Yeah. And then people were like, oh, I listen to these podcasts that are not fiction, and I was like, they're not podcasts then, because podcasts are only audio drama fiction. I don't know what you're talking about. And then discovered there is in fact an entire genre of non-fiction podcasts that I had no idea existed.
That's amazing. I feel like I
tapped into and enjoyed
making like aspic in the kitchen dressed as a 1950s housewife listening to a podcast.
Ye old timey radio play.
Exactly.
Of which there are many, and they are fantastic. If you're somebody who only listens to non-fiction podcasts, what are you doing? You should be listening to the fiction ones. They're fantastic.
Yeah. My podcast, Twisted Roots, you can listen to my one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. So start there.
The whole audiobook on here. But anyway.
You wrote an entire book. Like, that's an achievement. And then you decided to do the audiobook narration for it, which is also difficult. Like, you deserve the praise of...
You wrote
a book and it's available to buy, and if you're listening to this, you should buy it and you should read it and you should leave a 5-star review.
Yes. Oh my god, can I employ you just to follow me around and say that wherever I am? That would be great.
I am unemployed, so I'm available for any anything that people want to hire me for. Hype man, social media guru.
Yeah, murderous housewife.
Murderous housewife. I will come to your house and I will do the whole bit.
That is fantastic.
I'll bake you cookies and I'll also like threaten you.
Yeah, brilliant. I feel like I want to ask you a million more questions from everything you've said, but I am in my shed. I am freezing my ass off. And
I'll come back and we'll do a part two like later in the year.
All
the things you wanted to ask me but couldn't.
Oh my god, all of the things. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's been fantastic to be here. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I'll put all of your links will be in the description of this podcast.
And I'll say a couple of them now. Follow me on Twitter at WhatTheBlair, on Instagram at urban_barbarian, and my website is www.kblair.co.uk, and all of my publications are on my website. So with hyperlinks, so you can click them and go to them, and also buy some of the things that I'm in, because I'm in a few really cool anthologies that you should definitely buy, because not just for me, but for all the other amazing poets that are in them.
Having done some low-key artist stalking before this episode, I can actually say that Kath's website is fantastic and it's super easy to use, and you can go and buy stuff that they're in. A huge thanks to Kay Blair for joining me for this episode. Be sure to tune in next month for another episode of A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities and another incredible guest.